Hi, and welcome to the Friday Coffee Meter podcast for Friday, May 29th, 2020. On today's episode, we'll hear from Johara Tariq of Moonshot Capital for this week's virtual meetup about why venture fund size matters.
The Friday Coffee Meetup podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory, a Pasadena-based marketing and advertising agency that specializes helping healthcare, consumer goods, clean tech, and aerospace companies achieve rapid sustainable growth. Echo Factory CEO Mike Schaefer is a co-founder and organizer of Friday Coffee Meetup. If you're interested in how Echo Factory can help your company achieve rapid sustainable growth, you can learn more at echo-factory.com. Every week, the Friday Coffee Meetup brings together innovators, startups, investors, tech companies, and entrepreneurs at the cross-campus co-working space in Pasadena. You can learn more about upcoming meetups and how you can attend in person at fridaycoffeemeetup.com. Now, here's Johara with this week's presentation.
Let's grab some seats. We're going to get started in just a minute.
I'm really excited to introduce Johara Tariq of Moonshot Capital today. She is going to be talking about why fund size matters. So fund economics can really impact an entrepreneur and how they're looking at their fundraising. If the venture capital firm is expecting, you know, $1 billion valuation, that's going to affect the types of entrepreneurs that that fund attracts. So in your fundraising efforts, you might want to look at those fund economics as you're making your fundraising decisions. And with that, I am happy to introduce Johara. We are excited to hear from her. She has a really cool story and background. So welcome, Johara. I'm going to stop sharing and you can go ahead and share.
Thanks, Christy. I'm so excited to be here. So my name is Johara. I work at a firm called Moonshot Capital. We're a $20 million seed fund based in Los Angeles and Austin. So the firm is comprised of myself and the two GPs, and I'll get a little bit more into what Moonshot Capital does in my presentation. But to just give you my background, I've been an associate at Moonshot Capital for a little bit over a year, almost a year and a half now. So I completely fell into VC, which is why I thought this presentation would be important, because I think, you know, because venture is such an apprenticeship model, a lot of the way that I view things, especially in terms of how the entrepreneur should receive or take money from VCs, really comes from kind of the mentors that I've had throughout my career. So I went to UCLA. I'm an LA native, so super passionate about building up the LA ecosystem. But I had a past life working in public policy, where I lived in DC, working in affordable housing, and then later moved to San Francisco, where I did philanthropic consulting. So helping large philanthropic private foundations really achieve more impact using statistical analysis. While living in San Francisco, kind of got the tech bug. A lot of good friends of mine had joined really prominent companies such as Medallia and Flexport right before or after their Series A. And they just really felt like they were making a lot of impact. And I was just very excited about everything I was seeing. So I started kind of considering a career in tech. And then as I was starting to apply to some roles, happened to take myself out to a drink on a very rare sunny day in San Francisco and met a recruiter at a bar. 2 weeks later, I got a call from him asking if I'd ever considered working in DC, to which, of course, my answer was no. You know, I had a background in urban planning, affordable housing, philanthropy, geography major. My mom's a teacher. My dad didn't even go to college. Like, he worked in sales. So it was really kind of naive to the whole idea of venture capital. But of course, being me, I said, sure, why not? And I ended up working for a late stage firm that basically did secondary. So essentially about building positions in late stage enterprise software companies, and holding them for a while through exit. You know, secondaries, unlike direct venture capital, is a little bit different. Instead of directly, you know, investing in a company or an idea or a founder, essentially what you're doing is you're buying positions off of early employees, so their shares or even vintage venture funds, so that they can give liquidity to their LPs. And that's kind of how I learned this idea of VC and how I learned venture capital. And then eventually decided, you know, after being there for almost a year and a half, almost 2 years, decided not only did I want to go completely on the opposite side and work super early on the early stage, I wanted to leave, you know, this booming tech ecosystem that was called San Francisco and moved to a smaller one called Los Angeles. by kind of a little bit of luck and a lot of effort and just right timing, I ended up meeting the two GPs of Moonshots Capital, where I currently am. Have been there since March 2019, and since then have watched us deploy capital into 12 companies, so it's been a lot of fun. Okay, so today I'm going to talk about why venture fund size matters. So I'm going to share my screen. And hopefully you all can see this. Not getting any chats that you can't, so I'm going to take that as a note that you can. Okay. So this presentation is really inspired by one of my GPs. He wrote a really great Medium article about why founders should really consider the size of venture size, the size of venture fund, and everything that they consider when taking on venture capital money. Both my GPs have been longtime operators and entrepreneurs, and so they've taken money from the big funds like a Sequoia and Andreessen, and the small funds like us, Moonshots Capital. And it's really something that I think a lot of entrepreneurs don't even consider. Like, I think you consider the reputation, you consider what the backgrounds of the GPs, and all that's totally important, but actually venture fund size can really kind of make or break how your incentives align with your GPs and the partners of a fund. So excited to kind of dig into that. Okay, so first off, a little bit about Moonshots Capital. Moonshots Capital is a $20 million seed fund, like I mentioned, based in LA and Austin. And our thesis is this, great leaders are hard to come by. We believe the best ones are military trained or trial by fire entrepreneurs who have the ability to motivate others to action, inspire trust, and plan heuristically. Invest with conviction when those attributes are present by leading seed rounds and taking board seats. So we are a firm based in LA and Austin, and the firm was founded by my two GPs, a guy named Kelly Perdue and a guy named Craig Cummings. They both went to West Point, and so are military veterans. And after leaving the military for, I think, the collective 20 years, I went on to start some early businesses. Kelly started a company that was acquired by Active Networks, and Craig started a company that was acquired by Daimler. And we found that at the early stage, the only thing that really determines success is the quality of the leadership on the founding team. And given that both my partners have this military background, we've also found that there's really no other place in the military where folks are really trained to lead and execute. So we actually love to lean in extra hard when there's a military veteran on the founding team. We're currently operating out of Fund 1, which is a $20 million vehicle. And of the total dollars that we deployed out of Fund 1, about 53% has gone to military veteran entrepreneurs. The other 47-ish percent has gone to folks who were not military veteran entrepreneurs, but have really proven this idea of being great leaders, right? Which is what we call trial by fire entrepreneurs, have started companies before and are really taking their learnings into this new venture they're starting. Thus far, we've backed 14 companies. We've led 11 of those deals and taken board seats. And we're totally journalists. So we'll look at most things, and we have things in our portfolio from AR to smart wearables to SaaS to big data. So totally, totally journalists. Okay, so before jumping into why venture size matters and plays a role, one of the things I just wanted to show you was how what like deal flow kind of looks like. So this is something that Crunchbase puts out every quarter, just kind of like the state of deal volume. And this is taken from our most recent quarter. So as you can see, and as probably expected, coronavirus definitely has impacted deal flow, and I think this will continue. However, there's still like an abundant amount of deals, I think, I believe, that will continue to be done and that have historically been done, right? I think, you know, in the past, like, few years, you know, venture has been at an all-time high and deal volume has been enormous. And so although this is happening, I think it's still, you know, it's clear that there's like no lack of funding to be really had from VC. But I still think it's important to consider like the type of funding you're taking, because I think this will seriously impact how you run your business. So I just want to put this up to kind of frame our discussion. I think coronavirus will continue to definitely have an impact on types of deals we see and the deal volume. I think, you know, especially in Q1 where folks are a little bit concerned and worried and was at the beginning of it, and I think this will continue, but, you know, there's still myriad of funds that exist. There's still dollars to be deployed. And so I think we'll still continue to see high deal volume for, I believe, the next 12 months or so. Okay, so what is a micro VC? So VC funds under 100 million and those under 50 million, or you can call it per nano VCs, are referred to as micro funds. So most of the well-known VC funds that are household name of the venture industry, think your Sequoias, your Excels, your Benchmarks, your NEA, Kleiner Perkins, your Redpoints, have a larger AUM. AUM means total assets under management. They're a lot larger, right? Some of these funds have over a billion total across all their funds. Micro funds, however, which are kind of representative of a lot of funds here, specifically in LA, are under 100 million. So Moonshots Capital is considered, for example, a micro fund, as we're deploy money out of fund one, which is 20 million. So a couple of terms to keep in mind before I kind of jump into venture size and how that has effect on entrepreneurs' decision making are a few kind of just stakeholders in VC. So when I say general partners, right, also referred to as GPs, that typically is referred to as the partners of the fund, right? So these are the folks for our fund, it's Kelly and Craig, who raise money from the LPs, you know, find and meet and pursue these portfolio companies, make the final decision of investing dollars into these companies. You know, if you're someone like us, takes board seats to help, hopefully help companies grow and get to liquidity and report at least quarterly to LPs. And I'll jump into what that means. You can generally think of GPs as the operators of the fund. They're kind of the entrepreneurs of the VC business. Limited partners or LPs are investors in our fund. So they can be anything from a high net worth individual to large institutional investors, such as large endowments that invest money in these specific venture funds. The money from the LPs, of course, is then invested in the portfolio companies by the GPs or their general partners. And LPs and GPs actually sign a thing called an LPA, which is a limited partner agreement that governs the relationship between them, including funding requirements, reporting requirements, and distribution requirements. Okay, portfolio construction refers to how a GP thinks they're how they will deploy capital in the companies. So when LPs invest money in venture funds, they do so on the premise that GPs will eventually take this money and invest in companies that will hopefully exit and therefore provide these LPs with outside returns from these liquidity events, right? So when a company IPOs or gets acquired, whatever it may be. The venture asset class historically has outperformed most other classes across all time horizons. And it's the reason so much money is poured into VC over the last several decades. And I believe this will continue to ring true even after COVID. But in order for GPs to properly deploy, manage, and harvest money from their investment activities, they need a plan. And so every fund constructs a straw man portfolio to show LPs how they plan to invest the money they receive. And this is referred to as a portfolio construction. This plan typically includes a target number of companies. For us, I believe when we were raising on one, our target was anywhere from 12 to 15. We landed at 14. The total amount of invested into each company. So both like the first check-in, right, was the initial check, but also the follow-on of the fund reserves. For us, we call this dry powder. And for us, although we usually invest somewhere between 500,000 to 1 million for a first check, we actually reserve about 100% of the first check, if not more, for dry powder follow-on investment. Target ownership percentage for us is 10 to 15%. And the time frame that the GPs plan to spend making investments into these new companies, this is also referred to as investment period. So portfolio construction really consists of all this. So you can kind of think about it as like the framework, like how much money you're going to invest, how many companies, what that looks like how much ownership percentage you want, so how much of maybe the seed round or whatever state you're playing at you're going to take in account for. And different funds have different strategies. As you can imagine, given the wide myriad of backgrounds, difference in opinion on what a true portfolio construction should look like, right? There's no single way portfolio construction can look. Even what a fund's LP base is can have different bearings on how a GP thinks through their fund strategy, right? And every fund can be a little bit different on how they think about portfolio construction and how they focus on making investments. So So some VCs employ like a spray and pray strategy. So for example, they'll invest in like a larger amount of companies with smaller checks and achieving smaller ownership percentage with the hope that one of them is going to be a large hit, but they're spread out more diversified for the likelihood of that happening. But firms like us have employed like a different strategy. So we like to invest with conviction, and so we do bigger checks in a smaller amount of companies and more concentrated portfolio. And the idea here is that we believe that although, you know, the spray and pray portfolio construction can absolutely work, we believe that you should double down and really help to build a great company. And so by having a smaller amount of portfolio, we can add more value and spend more time working with our portfolio companies. This is kind of playing into the idea that we take board seats. So, you know, when looking at different types of funds, portfolio construction can really change. So what I basically have here on this slide is like we're taking a micro VC like ourselves, and I have lined out kind of what our portfolio construction looks like. And then let's call like a larger fund A. So think a fund that is about $500 million. So there's a few key differences, right? So obviously we're much smaller, we're a micro VC, we're about $20 million, we're $20 million in fund one. And let's say larger fund A is a larger institutional fund. Maybe they're raising fund three and it's $500 million, right? So definitely not a micro VC because it's over that $100 million mark. So our average investment size plus reserves, as I kind of hit on a little bit, our average first check size is about $500,000 to $1 million. But we reserve dry powder, our follow-on, to invest in companies that, you know, will go on to raise larger rounds after our first round of financing, with the idea being that we want to maintain our ownership percentage, right? And we want to continue to support the company. Let's say our average investment size plus reserves ends up being looking so that we have been investing about $1 to $2.5 million-ish out of the fund by the time a company exits. Our larger fund, being that they're much bigger, they're able to put larger checks to work even throughout the investment life cycle of a company. So let's say that their average investment size plus their reserves, you know, plus their dry powder ends up being about $10 million. We target 10 to 15% ownership. A larger fund typically, because they are putting more money to work, usually targets anywhere from 20 to 30%. And our target return is 3X. So meaning that our hope is that, you know, with our $20 million fund, when by the time all of our companies exit, we've achieved at least $60 million from the fund, right? And the reason that I put 3X across us and a larger fund is because to be in the top quartile of funds, that means that you are 3Xing your fund. So you're returning your fund three times. A number of GPs can vary across the fund. We have two GPs at Moonshots, but, you know, larger funds, because there's more money, and especially if they have multiple funds, you can see, you know, some still have like maybe one or two GPs. Very rare, I think, you'll start to see that there are more GPs. And the only reason I added this is because this obviously has bearing on the way that a portfolio is constructed as well, right? More folks, more ideas. This all has bearing on how a VC achieves returns. Okay, so now we're going to do a little bit of math. So when you're a $500 million fund, right, let's assume that you have a 25% ownership at exit with a company worth $1 billion, right? So with that company, you have $1 billion exit and you own 25%, you are receiving, as larger fund A, $250 million. So that will, $250 million will be returned to the fund. Obviously, this is great. We all love our unicorns, such as like our Ubers, right? But in order to really achieve the top quartile performance, you're gonna need five more unicorn exits, right? In order to 3X the fund, right? Because you're, let's say on average, throughout that life cycle, you still own 25% of that $1 billion exit, so 250 million times six, that's 3X in the fund. Now, this looks a little different when you're looking at like a smaller micro VC. So for a 20 million fund like ourselves, and let's assume on the lower end, our target ownership percentage is 10-15. So let's assume that we own 10% at exit. With a company worth 250 million, that means 25 million will be returned to the fund. So with one company not even being exiting as a unicorn, but rather exiting at 250 million, that exit more than returns the fund. So why does this matter, right? Well, the reason this matters is because this will definitely change the way a VC kind of chases these returns, right? The whole point of venture is not only to support the entrepreneur, right, and invest in these big companies and these big ideas and change the world, but in order for a VC to exist, they have to return money to their LPs. And the idea being that as an LP, right, I believe that venture creates outsized returns. So I'm hoping that I'm investing in a fund that will 3X my money. So this starts to play a role if you're a larger fund and your strategy. So larger funds just most basically will pursue larger exits, right? As I showed you in the math in the previous slide, you know, $250 million exit for a $500 million fund, that's not going to work. We need multiple billion-dollar exits just to 3X the fund. So what happens is larger funds will tend to focus on hypergrowth, right? They will push the founders to increase marketing spend in order to achieve these outsized exits. Larger funds also have more dry powder, right? They're larger funds. They know that they can continue to have their 25% ownership percentage throughout the life cycle, play later rounds with larger checks. So there's really not a need to have their companies focus on profitability. Instead, you know, maybe they realize that they're going to continue to be able to back the company. And so instead they'll push for growth over profitability. And just most basically, larger funds will see smaller exits as optimal, right? A $250 million exit, that's not going to even put a dent in the fund to return back to the LPs. So it could be that, you know, a company maybe receives an acquisition offer, but because of the venture math, their larger funds who are on their cap table will push them to reject some of these acquisition offers because the idea is that maybe their exit or IPO later down the line will yield more funds, right? And despite this, right, larger funds still have a tremendous amount of value that they could add. Because they're bigger, they have deeper pockets to further bridge the company. They're able to write larger checks and play at multiple stages, right? As a smaller micro VC, there's only a certain amount out of a fund that we can use for follow-on, and then we're tapped out. At a larger fund, this looks different just simply because they have more funds. And also, these larger funds have more resources. They're able to add value through non-cash resources, such as recruiting personnel, marketing, and development. So there's definitely some pros and cons. It's just a difference in, like, how they back these companies. And this becomes especially important, you know, as an early stage founder when you're taking your capital, because there's just a difference in behavior and GPs from a micro VC fund that's 20 million, like Moonshot Capital, versus a larger fund that's about 500 million. So it's important that founders and investors are aligned on target outcomes, right? And the difference in behavior between the large funds and the micro funds is most apparent when maybe a portfolio company gets an acquisition offer in the 50 million to 250 million range. Right. So for an entrepreneur, that outcome can be a complete legacy changer, especially if they have a good amount of ownership percentage. Right. And for the micro VC, right, a $15 million to $250 million exit can still be a fund returner and a fund maker even. But for the larger fund, it's considered a suboptimal outcome. So in the same ways that founders are encouraged to align on products, what leadership looks like in KPIs when they're taking investment from a venture capitalist, it's important to also be aligned on what a successful outcome looks like, right? Because depending on size of venture fund, that can look really, really different for both the founder and the GP at a VC. So that is the end of my presentation.
Great.
I think I somehow got it.
That was connected. Fantastic. Nope. We're here. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah, my video got disconnected.
Okay, I'm going to turn my video back on here. Okay. For those of you who are on the line, go ahead and put your questions into the Q&A chat box. Let's see here. We have an initial question, and I did answer one question about distributing the presentation. We actually have a challenge about distributing presentations through Meetup, so we're not going to be doing that. But you can always rewatch the video via YouTube, our YouTube channel. So with that, let me go ahead with our first question. Let's see here. In your global deal volume, is the amount in thousands or millions or question mark? I'm not sure I understand that whole question. I might have missed it in the slide.
Repeat the question. Sorry.
In your global deal volume, is the amount in thousands or millions? I think you answered that. right?
Oh, your, and CB Insights. Your, yeah, that is in millions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Millions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have a question while we wait for other questions to show up on the line. And you can turn your video back on, Jahara, if you'd like.
Yeah, so right now we're seeing. I exited Zoom, so I think you have to, like, let me back in as a panelist. So
oh, okay. Let's do that really quick. No problem. Let's get you back over here. Let's see. There we go. So with the – okay. Let me think of how I'm going to phrase this. Your fund, I really love the math slide that you did and the returns, how that affected returns by having the smaller fund size. Do you see any shifts in, based on COVID, for fund sizes? Do you think for really large funds, do you think they will stay that way and still accept unicorns, or do you think that they will maybe scale back on fund sizes to adjust for maybe adjustments in the market that don't really allow for as many unicorns?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. I think what we're gonna end up seeing is that fund sizes are just gonna be smaller, I think, over the next 5 to 10 years. And I don't think that's necessarily going to be intentional. I think that, you know, venture being that it's like one of the most illiquid asset classes means that because of what the markets are going to do and what I think we're looking at, which I believe is going to be a long global recession, means that more folks are going to be a little bit, I mean, I think this will, and when I'm talking about LPs right now, I'm talking more like family offices and high net worth individuals. I think this likely proves less bearing on larger institutional funds. So like, think like your endowments, right? Because that money's already kind of been accounted for and allocated. But I think we're gonna start to see smaller funds. I think we're kind of at the end of days with like these large mega seed funds that were popping out everywhere just simply because there's less liquidity and less folks willing to put that into the venture asset class. And so I think, and you know, I don't know, but I think what's going to happen, I don't think that people are gonna stop pursuing large unicorns. I think the basis of venture is that, you know, every time you invest in a company, what makes it a venture backable business is that it has this large market and that it will produce these outside returns and hopefully be a unicorn. But I think you will start to see valuations that are more right sized to reflect the market. So less insane valuations, and perhaps, like, you know, when these companies IPO, the valuations will be less. I think we'll see smaller funds just by nature of LPs. Maybe allocating less of their money into the venture asset class. And I think that what you will also see is deal volume continue to go down for a bit, at least initially, while people start to kind of readjust and figure out our new normal. And I think you will see that start to go up in about a year, or as soon as we have large antivirals or vaccines, because I think at this point, folks are still trying to adjust to the new normal of completely deploying capital without meeting the founder in person.
Yeah. Let's try your video and get that back on before we go to our next question.
Sure. My video not on?
No.
Oh.
We see kind of your green, we see a green circle with your telephone.
Oh. Let's see. I can try calling back in.
I think we can hear you on the line, but maybe it's just like your online.
It does. I can see my video. Let's see if I pin it. Can you see that?
Not yet. Not yet. Let's see here. Okay. She has two, her phone and her video. Let me go back in the attendees and see if there's another attendee I can pull over to. Let's see. Okay. I'm not sure. We can just go ahead. It's okay.
Okay.
Let's see. Is there a transition plan from micro to larger VC, or do micro funds want a complete exit before the round ends?
Sorry, repeat that question. I don't think I understand.
Is there a transition plan from micro to larger VC, or do micro funds kind of want a complete exit before they would go to like a larger VC, maybe for a larger round?
Okay, so the question, I think the question is, like, as an entrepreneur, when you take money from a micro VC, what does that look like if you, for the next round, consider taking money from a larger VC? Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm specifically talking about the seed stage. I mean, I think when you start looking at growth capital and later stage funds, they by nature have to be a lot larger, right? They're writing checks anywhere sometimes from like 10 million to 30 million, right? But I think, you know, not every company gets to the point where they're taking larger rounds of funding, right? Usually companies that are continuing to take larger rounds of funding and taking like those Series B, Series E, Series F checks, it's because they have a larger VC that came in at the early stage. And the idea being like, in order to achieve these metrics of growth, they have to continue to fundraise. So I think that, you know, there's not necessarily a transition plan that needs to be in place, but rather I think this circles back to, you know, what I was saying in that even at the early stage, you need to kind of be mindful of like, how much VC do you really need to raise in order to achieve what you want from a company, the type of exit that you want. If you're going to be trying to have a billion dollar exit, likely at the early stage, you see that billion dollar exit and you're going to be chasing that. And maybe your initial check is from a micro VC, but like for your Series A, Series B, you're kind of coming down those larger funds. But there's very successful venture-backed companies that of course kind of chase those exits in the $200 to $400 million range. And that means that at the early stage, they're okay taking money from micro VCs and to kind of set out with the idea of like after my seed round or after my Series A, hitting profitability, right? Which just completely changes kind of your modus operandi.
Great. In the near term, is it likely that VCs will avoid first-time founders and maybe focus only on veteran founders?
No, I think that, you know, I will believe that a successful founder can come from anywhere. I mean, I have such an untraditional background myself and arguably so do both my GPs, right? They're two military dudes turned operators, turned like venture investors by kind of accident, by just kind of being the ecosystem for long enough and thinking there's a huge hole here, let's fill it. And so I think great ideas can come from anywhere. And I think people will continue to chase founders and just great ideas in general. I think, you know, unfortunately, the fact of the matter is first-time founders always have kind of an extra hurdle to get over because, of course, a lot of VC is just pattern matching. And, you know, if you've started a company before, I just believe that those learnings can, you know, are already established. But I've looked at plenty of deals with first-time founders. We've gotten really close to plenty of deals with first-time founders. We don't really have any in our fund, per se. But, well, we have one. We have one co-founder who's a first-time founder. So, I mean, I think that doesn't matter. I think people will continue to be open to that, just chase great ideas. I think the biggest hurdle is just as a first-time founder, the idea that it's, you know, it's first time, everything is harder. And you're, of course, getting over that hurdle, proven that you really understand your market and venture capital. But I think, you know, funds will continue to be open to that.
I understand that microlending has better outcomes in terms of people repaying. Do you have data on the success rate of microfund versus large VC funded investment?
I do somewhere and I can dig it up. but the idea being that I think, you know, one of the reasons why we are microfund is because we believe that we can provide better returns for LPs, right? And that kind of boils down to the math that I was showing. $20 million fund achieving like 3x returns means I'm returning $60 million to my LPs. I believe that we could do that more easily than a $400 million fund can 3x their fund because they simply need more unicorns. There's data on that. I don't think it's super recent, right, as of 2020, but there's actually good data out there, I believe, by First Bank. I might be wrong. Somewhere in our actual, like, pitch deck, actually, for our investors, that kind of denotes why people are backing micro VCs and why that makes sense. And in fact, I think the reason we saw the emergence of so many micro VCs over the past 10 years is for this very reason, the idea that it's able to return the asset class in a more feasible way.
Because this wasn't your background, what do you think, what are some of your biggest learnings kind of going through this process and becoming a VC? I mean, it's a really cool, I love the transition from your background to your story today. I would love to hear some of the lessons that you've learned kind of in your own path.
Yeah, I think the biggest transition, I mean, I think every day is a learning experience, and to be quite honest, like, although my partners have like a long background in tech and operating, like this is their first like LP committed fund, which is still just like so different than having a fund, or just like running syndicates or angel investing. And so I'd like to think that everything from like how we run our fund to culture setting kind of changes and evolves for the better every day. And so I feel like every day is truly a learning experience. I think the biggest piece for me, I think when I first started in venture, I think I was most nervous about really understanding like how to financial model, et cetera, right? Because I just don't have a background on that. But I found that the biggest learning curve has been like how to like really understand founders quickly and understand their like companies to be able to like spit it back out to them in like three sentences. And so really kind of like taking this amount of information on oftentimes subjects that I'm too stupid intrinsically to understand, and kind of being able to relay it back to them and my partners.
Our next question is, thanks for sharing that. Does Moonshot Capital invest in companies looking or developing SARS-CoV-2 detection technologies for Corona? It's someone who's looking for an investment.
So we don't invest in biotech, so unfortunately kind of outside of what I can do. But I mean, I definitely have seen, we do invest in software. So we've seen a lot of things about like contact tracing or trying to combat social distancing or being a solution for that. So I think, you know, a lot of VCs, and we've seen this since the beginning of COVID, have been big advocates for how to respond and creating vaccinations. And I think that a lot of biotech funds, that is something they're absolutely considering and looking into.
Cool. And for this person, you might also check WaveMaker 360 Health. We had Kwame Ulmer the other week. They do invest in healthcare. And Cairo Spencers also does some life sciences pieces. So those might be some things for you to check out. Okay, that's all of our questions for today. Did this bring up anything else? Anything else you would like to share with us or discuss today?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, for me, I think what's important to keep in mind, especially as we all kind of navigate this new world we're living in, is like how I guess we relate to each other. And I think it's going to be a big learning curve for both how founders seek the right investors and how investors seek founders. And so I think that kind of keeping that in mind and starting to get creative with navigating COVID and this new normal is important for any founder trying to raise capital.
The Friday Coffee Meetup podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory. Learn more about how Echo Factory can help your business achieve rapid, sustainable growth at echo-factory.com. And get all the details about upcoming Friday Coffee Meetup episodes at fridaycoffeemeetup.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.